Just as a reminder, please turn off your cell phones and Blackberries, etc. And what we're going to do today is we're going to hear Senate Bill 1078, so I'm going to open a public hearing on that at this time. Senator Metzger, did you want to address this bill?
Yes, briefly. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to come and do this. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. Senate Bill 1078 is a piece of legislation to recognize the original Oregonians in time for the 150-year sesquicentennial of the state of Oregon. It is apparent to, I think, all of us that as we look forward to the 150-year statehood, as we honor those who created this state, and 1078 recognizes the original Oregonians, the nine federally recognized tribes of Oregon, to be appropriately recognized on the state park, state capitol grounds, within the Walk of the Flags monument. It is anticipated that this effort then will be allowed to be ready for the commemoration and dedication a year from yesterday for that 150th year anniversary. Actually, this idea I'd like to claim was my own. It was not. I heard a speech by Governor Schweitzer from Montana last fall who recognized that in honoring all the heroes of Montana and those who made that great state, that they failed to recognize the original Montanans and did that on their capitol grounds, that it was very appropriate. And as I recognize that we had not done that here in Oregon, that would be an appropriate recognition. 1078 is not prescriptive. It allows the Department of Indian Affairs, the State Parks Department, also the Capitol Foundation, to work together to provide what would be an appropriate memorial of their efforts and their contributions to the state. It also allows for this to be funded entirely by private donations and not be funded by the state. I do want to go on the record as saying, as I got a note, that the Capitol Projects Advisory Board is involved in anything that happens on the Capitol Mall, and would say on the record that they should be also consulted, and all parties certainly agree that that will take place. You will hear, I think, from one of the representatives of one of the tribes regarding this bill. I think one thing that's really important to recognize in the history of the state, Oregon would not have become a state in 1859 without the support of the tribes. Congress required that the tribes' compact treaties be signed and delivered to Congress before they would okay statehood. So if it wasn't for their efforts and agreements, we would not be having the 150-year anniversary tomorrow. So I commend the bill to you, and I would appreciate your support, and thank you for the opportunity to testify on this piece of legislation today.
Thank you. Any questions before, Senator? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Berger, would you like to come up? Thank you for taking time and coming to our committee on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Vicki Berger, State Representative, District 20, and I'm hoping you're on Senate Bill 1078.
Yes.
Because I walked in the room cold. I will be very brief. I am a member of the board of the Oregon State Capitol Foundation, who have created the Walk of the Flags, which is a wonderful addition to our Capitol grounds. The Oregon State Capitol Foundation has lots of projects. We could use money at all times. And if you're not members of Friends of the Capitol, I would encourage all of you to be so. We are supportive of this project. We hope to it will further enhance what we are trying to do in making our Capitol very special for all Oregonians, and that's the substance of my testimony.
Any questions? I have one question. How does one become a friend of Capitol?
I will be sure that is a brochure and application is delivered to all of your offices forthwith. It only costs $25 a year, and we think everyone should be a friend of the Oregon State Capitol who works and is associated with this building. So I will have application materials sent to your offices promptly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, before
yes.
you leave, I'm assuming that you would take more than $25 a year.
Oh, we take, actually, the foundation itself has created an endowment, and we take very large donations. But the simple thing is to be a capital friend, and we want to make everyone, we want to make it easy for everyone to be a capital friend. But oh, trust me, Representative, we will take larger amounts as donations to our organization, which is the Oregon State Capital Foundation.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Michael Mason and Justin Martin, if you both like to come up together, that would be terrific.
Too close to that. Chair Riley and members of the House Government Accountability and Information Technology Committee. Michael Mason in Portland, representing the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to testify in favor of Senate Bill 1078 today. I think it is a significant bill. Unlike one of the local papers in the ceded area of the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs, we think it is significant to have a monument so that the people can actually be reminded that there are Oregon tribes still. I mean, I talk to people whose kids are going to school. They come home and say, gee, it's great that there were these Indians in Oregon. Are there any left? And for that to happen is astounding, but also frightening. I wanted to comment briefly. You know, all of the tribes, let me say this, made treaties with the United States. Many of the tribes who made treaties in 1851 particularly did not have those treaties ratified. But starting in 1853, the Congress did start to ratify the treaties, and particularly with tribes in western Oregon. And then in 1855, in a whirlwind tour of the Pacific Northwest, Isaac Stevens and Joel Palmer, of course, a former speaker of this House, negotiated treaties with tribes all the way from the coast all the way into Montana. And it's those 1855 treaties that set the stage for Oregon statehood, because they involved almost, you know, if I'm thinking correctly, which doesn't always happen, approximately a third of Oregon was covered by those 1855 treaties, and quite a bit of Washington, Idaho, and western Montana. And again, that those needed to be done, and they were actually the Senate, on the U.S. Senate's desk, when the Act of Statehood was passed and ratified shortly after that by the U.S. Senate. The U.S. Senate at that time was a very deliberative body, and so an 1855 treaty took 4 years it took a little time to get across the country, first of all, with the document, but it did take a little while to get ratification. But making sure that the Columbia and the Snake, or originally the Lewis's River, that the land title issues were taken care of on that lifeline to the rest of the United States was very, very important. And I would say, too, and this applies to some of my ancestors who came out on the Oregon Trail, that, you know, if you look back even before the treaties, how many of the pioneers would actually have survived if they had not had access to salmon caught by Indians along the trail, certainly from, you know, Farewell Bend on west to Oregon City. I think the numbers of deceased would have been very, very much higher. So that's certainly a major factor in the survival of the pioneers and the ability to have enough people here to have the critical mass for Congress to consider Oregon for statehood. And I could go on and on, but I thought we were doing a dog and pony show. I'm the old dog, and here's the pony. So Justin will, I think, carry on the more modern connections and benefits of tribal existence. But I would just say one more thing, and that's that you know, Oregon does have a stain on its history, and that's the termination of so many of the tribes in the 1950s. That has been corrected some years ago. In fact, you're coming up on, what, 25th anniversary of restoration of Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. So that's also something to celebrate.
November.
Gosh, that's the thing about the old dog part. Okay, thanks. And I, again, thank you for your consideration and urge your due pass recommendation for Senate Bill 1078.
Committee, if you hold your questions, and we'll get both at the same time.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Justin Martin. I'm here today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. I'm also very pleased to work with the Oregon Tribal Gaming Alliance, which represents all nine federally recognized tribes here in Oregon. And as Mr. Mason alluded to earlier, I'm also very pleased to be up here with him as a colleague who actually hired me 11 years ago this month to come and build a government relations program at Grand Ronde. So I'm eternally grateful to Michael for that. And we are very pleased to be here in front of you today in support of Senate Bill 1078. Oregon, in recent history, has done a tremendous job in getting out in front of the rest of the country and has been truly unique in the way it has approached state-tribal relations. From the creation of the Commission on Indian Services under Governor Vic Atiyah's administration to recent legislative years and proposals which some of you have been a part of, creation of Native American teaching licenses here in Oregon, creation of local mental health authorities on reservations that can serve not just tribal populations but the community at large, deletion of offensive language in Oregon geographic board names, making stiffer penalties for illegally held archaeological objects, and finally, a true piece of landmark legislation, Senate Bill 770, which encourages state agencies and tribal agencies to communicate on a yearly basis to really create that reciprocal education that I think makes tribal government and state government that much better. That is truly unique. We can be very proud here in Oregon of our accomplishments. This bill is in that true spirit of the government-to-government relationship, and we look forward to having just another educational piece, especially here on the state grounds, that really emphasizes both the economic and the cultural makeup of this great state, which really does make Oregon a unique and magical place. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again, we urge your support of Senate Bill 1078. We're very pleased to be here and very proud to be in this great state of Oregon. Thank you.
I just wanted to comment. I'm very proud that this legislation has come forward as well. As you both know, I'm the appointed House member of the Commission on Indian Services. In addition, my daughter-in-law is a full-blooded Native American, one-quarter Grand Ronde, one-quarter Siletz, and half Crow. And I have a grandson on the way who's going to be following in that tradition. So I'm very proud that this bill has come forward, and I'm very supportive. And thank you both for being here. I see no questions, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to speak on this bill? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1078, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1078. Is there any discussion about this?
Mr. Chair, do you want a motion?
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, I move we pass Senate Bill 1078 engrossed to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
We have a motion to pass Senate Bill 1078A engrossed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection?
No.
So ordered. You know what? I'm going to carry this one myself. And thank you very much for this opportunity to carry that. With that, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1078. And I'm going to open a informational meeting on eCourt business plan. You want to tell us what this is about a little bit, do you?
I'll do my best, Mr. Chair. Okay. This is a follow-up to an interim committee that studied some of the technology support in the criminal in our criminal justice and court system. I believe.
Thank you. With that, is Sarah Gates here as well? Or no? Okay. Well, if you will just
yes, she's here.
I'm here, but I'm not going to testify.
You're not going. You're behind. Oh, there you are.
I play backup.
Okay, good. So, if you go ahead with your presentation, that would be great.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bud Borgia, and I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Oregon Judicial Department. I want to thank you for the opportunity to come back to this committee. Last year, we had an opportunity to give you an update on eCourt, and we wanted to come back again and provide you updates that have happened this past year. Back in December, we had an opportunity to speak in front of an interim committee on court technology to go over our business case and talk about how our process has evolved. From there, we received unanimous support to move forward with eCourt. Yesterday, we presented in front of Full Ways and Means our proposal. We had a very positive meeting, and we'll be focusing the rest of this week and next week with LFO to work out the next steps. So with that, I would like to talk about eCourt. I believe you should have a PowerPoint presentation in your packet, which is not showing up on the screen right now, but we'll be able to walk through it. Oh, there we go. Okay. So as a reminder, what is eCourt? eCourt is really a business transformation that we're focusing on. It is changing the way we fundamentally do business within the courts. The technology is really the enabler piece, but the real work is happening within the courts. The industry and the world has been evolving. eBay, Amazon, the airline industry, banking has changed the bar of how people want to do business. Coming into a courthouse and standing in line, filling out paper forms, filing paper forms, is not the way people want to interact. They want to be able to do things online and be able to do things around their schedule, not a schedule set by 8 to 5 Monday through Friday. So the demand has been there for us to start that evolution that others have set the market. So what we're talking about here is looking at ways we can leverage things that have already been done. We're talking about the ability for self-service, being able to pay online, being able to fill out a form online, and being able to submit that form, being able to see documents online and be able to, if you wish to receive a copy, have a copy sent to you electronically. We're also focusing on getting away from a paper-intensive process. Moving to electronic documents has significant benefits for us. Today, we have a master case file. The ability to find that case file when multiple people need it forces us into a linear business process. One person at a time can process pieces of that file. As we move forward, we'll have the ability to have multiple people working with the case file at the same time. And we're looking at as our business processes need to evolve. We've been fundamentally doing business the same way within the courts for the last 150 years. That same process, that paper-based process, has not evolved. So part of this is to say, how do we get that process to be the same and done the right way across the board? What we're doing is not bleeding-edge technology. These are things that have been going on in other industries as well as other courts. The Federal Bankruptcy Court, for example, has mandated electronic filing. They will not take paper anymore. So what we're looking to embark on has already been done and has been in place in quite a few places. Other states and local governments have varying degrees of this already in place. California, Washington, Colorado, Minnesota, Missouri, Florida are all in place. And then counties specifically within other states have already moved forward with this. So we're not looking for an unproven ground. What we're talking about is mainstream technology that we can adopt and move to the next level. Our approach is actually very unique for Oregon. We have top leadership from the Chief Justice. We have a governance technology committee made up of judges and trial court administrators. But what makes us unique is we have a unified court structure here. We have a trial court administrator model. In a lot of other states, each county has a separately elected court of clerk and separate systems. They can do what they want that is different from the next county. We have the opportunity here of one unified system that we can use. We have a model where the trial court administrators are all in close contact with each other and are working for a common goal. The other piece working for Oregon is we have a single case management system that's been in place since 1985. We've also not invested any significant dollars into technology since then, which means we don't have a lot of one-off technology pieces that we'd have to convert. We also have very strong partnerships with the Bar Association, with state police, with Department of Corrections, with Department of Justice, that are all behind moving forward with eCourt. The eCourt solution really has three main components. There is the technology component. How does this look on the web? The central systems that will be needed. But it really impacts the facilities and the employees within the court. And it does impact the public, how they will do business, and again, our public safety partners. So the courthouse on the web, what we're talking about is a virtual courthouse that allows people to have access 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, from wherever they are. Again, the standard business forms and practices. And this is in addition to what we do today. This is not to replace or take away anything that is in place. You can always come into the courthouse and do business as you would today. You can always mail for a request. So we're not taking those things away. We're adding another venue for people to be able to interact with the courts. We have strong partner integration, and one of the things we're really focusing on is making sure that the information that is available is something that is real-time and accessible by everyone. To have a complete holistic view of all of our data is imperative. We exchange a lot of information with the other public safety agencies, and it's by aggregating that information and making sure it's correct and making sure it's complete that everyone can do their jobs better. It is making sure that our information, when a judge is on the bench, has access to the information to make the right decisions. Today, a judge cannot see if there are outstanding charges on another case because we're in a case-based system. They do not have complete information to make the best decisions. Our information is not available to the officer on the street when they pull someone over to know if that person is wanted for something else. Part of this integration layer is to make sure all of that information is there, it's complete and accessible to everyone. The technology in the courthouse. We also want to make sure at every courthouse we do have the ability to have the use of technology, and these are things that we have been working on to standardize. The ability to have a wireless access connection in the courthouse, the ability to use video so you don't have to transfer prisoners from a corrections institution. Again, the core systems that we're talking about a portal, an internet-based access, a document, the content management or document management piece, so we are talking about electronic documents, a case management system that's person-based, not case-based, so we can see a complete view of a person. Again, the ability to share information through a partner integration backbone, the ability to make decisions through a business intelligence and decision support. The other key part on the bottom, actually the biggest part, really is the business transformation. How do we make ourselves ready for this? How does the organization become ready for a change of this magnitude? And that's where a huge part of our organizational readiness is focused. It is a fundamental operational change across the board. The way judges work today, for example, they read documents, case files online. They sign things manually. This transformation will allow that to be looking at the documents online, signing documents electronically, which adds time back into their day. A brief example, as we saw in Lee County, Florida, a typical processing session took almost 4 hours, and then the judge had to do signing of orders back in chambers afterwards. At the end of their transformation, that time was cut almost in half, and that included all the signings right then and there. The judge had no additional work that needed to happen back in chambers. So it does change fundamentally how people will work, and that impact has a ripple effect from a judge to how someone will use the system, whether that's filing online versus filling out a paper form and submitting it. How we process that form today, which is manually taking it in and cataloging it versus having it all happen online. The benefits to everyone is timely access to justice is probably the key piece. We have multi-jurisdictional places where a judge primarily stays in one area and goes to another area once a week. The cases in that other area typically wait a full week, and when the judge shows up there, there's a pile somewhere from 6 to 18 inches high on his desk of all the cases he's going to look at. That is a long delay before someone can have access to justice. This would allow that time to be cut down dramatically. It simplifies the whole process of creating a document on paper and having that linear process of that paper document. So the efficiency across the board is gained. The information, again, to people is complete, and people can make better decisions by having all of the correct information. And this really fulfills our mission of ensuring public safety, providing just, prompt, and safe resolution of civil disputes, and provides judicial services for family in crisis. We have adopted a staged approach to e-court. One of the key things we really wanted to do was put together a model that allows each piece to move forward by reducing risk, reducing complexity. We also wanted a stage approach that allowed for us to move forward, offer real value, and not be held to having each stage done. So what that means is that we have the flexibility that if there are funding constraints down the road after stage three, for example, we are able to take a break and still derive real value from each stage until funding becomes available. What this does is it allows us to come back after each stage to the legislature, provide an update, and request additional funding for the next stage. This is not asking for all the money up front and then saying, oh, we ran out, and coming back for more. This allows for controlled oversight after every piece, and each piece provides significant value that we will be able to use regardless if future stages are funded. The first couple of stages is really working on pilots. And what we'll see in a little bit is actually a prototype of one of the pilots. But we're working on a very schedule of creating a pilot process in stage 1 through 4. And we'll be focusing on our four courts of Multnomah, Yamhill, Crook, Jefferson, and Jackson counties, which is a variety from our largest court to a multi-jurisdictional court to a medium and a small court. Each having their unique set of characteristics. From there, once the pilots are successful, the last stages really talk about rollout across the state. Again, rollout can go as fast or as slow as money becomes available. This kind of gives an overview of here's the stages, here's when they tentatively are scheduled, and costs of each stage. Again, each stage offering a different set of of real value and pieces that are usable that are not dependent on the next piece. One of the things that we've done is we've looked at different ways to make sure we are successful with this project. A phased-in implementation of the major technologies, again, the staged approach, which allows us to bring our lessons learned from each stage into the next one. Multiple opportunities for legislative oversight, moderate financial investment. Each stage, we're only talking about the money for that particular stage, not the whole thing in aggregate. Business value, again, from each stage without having to have the future stages completed. An independent quality assurance oversight. We are voluntarily participating with the DAS quality assurance oversight as well. We have strong executive leadership with the buy-in of our Chief Justice. Again, a strong technology governance model with made up of judges and trial court administrators from across the state. And we've invested in a strong project management office. What I want to show just real briefly today is this is how the screens look in our case management system. They are traditional systems that are 25 years old. They are known as green screen character-based systems. You'll notice they are also code-based. They are not using English words. It is not user-friendly and is not intuitive. When this system was developed, space was at a premium. Each character, the cost of storing each character was very expensive, so we had to go with code-based to come up with ways to save money. The fields are also, in some cases, free-form, meaning they are not searchable or indexable. So where we can have information on a particular screen, we are not able today to use that information to the best of its ability and report off of it because of how the system was originally built. What I'd like to do now is actually bring up a couple of our key folks that have been working on a prototype of how the new system will look. And what we're talking about is starting with the highest court in the land, the Supreme Court, being the first e-court in the state of Oregon. And what we'd like to show is a very short prototype. And this is one of the things we don't normally do, but this is a live prototype. Going out online and actually seeing this. This is not a mock-up or a PowerPoint presentation, but actually making a real connection to our test site of our application. So what I'm going to do now, and unless there's specific questions, is have some people come up and actually show you the prototype.
Mr. Chair, I do have some questions, but I could wait. I've been writing them down. And
yeah,
I could wait till after, or I could ask them now. Or
if that's not a problem, I'd prefer that we wait and get all of our questions at the end.
Thank you.
And you'll still be in the room so we can ask you questions.
Yes, sir. I'll actually stay up at the table.
Good morning, Chair Riley and committee members. My name is James Woolen-Weber. I'm from the Oregon Judicial Department, and my colleague Diane Swint and I will be presenting to you the prototype that we have for eCourts e-filing today. What I'm going to do is show you a perspective from an attorney who would come into the system and be looking to e-file. The attorney that I will show you today has already registered for the system. So I will go ahead and show you what he or she might see. In this case, it'll be a he. And then my colleague Diane will go ahead and show you what it will look like internally once that process goes. So this is the Supreme Court website, and an attorney would navigate to here and then be able to see a link here and go ahead and click on this. And then what we have here is a landing point for attorneys that are interested in e-filing but maybe haven't registered yet. They can come here and they can find out a little bit more about e-court as well as e-filing, get facts, look at terms and conditions, and then if they needed to register, they could do that here as well. If they've already registered, they can go ahead and just hit this login button. And this will bring them to our secure portal. This is where they will authenticate to the system. So I'll go ahead and do that today. Now what you're seeing is a web portal view similar to what you might have seen sometimes if you've gone to Google or Yahoo. This is the same idea. And each one of these little pieces in here is called a portlet, and those portlets just contain information. As you can see, we have a portlet here to launch our e-filing and another one here to do business with our OGIN online service. Now the nice thing about this is once you have authenticated in the front piece, then you'll be able to go ahead and launch any type of service that you've already subscribed for. This area that you see on the screen now is completely customizable, and here's an example of a customized version of it. This is an example of what's known as an RSS feed from law.com. Basically, it just shows you headlines that are on that website and will dynamically update. Here's another example of just a weather forecast and a directions piece that you can get. There are over 400 different types of portlets that can be added, and we can allow different portlets to be put in there and also have our own in there that we would like to show on a regular basis. So we'll go ahead and launch the e-filing application. So the attorney has come in, and he now sees that he has a dashboard here of the different statuses for his filings. What you'll see is on the left here, there's a draft area, pending, rejected, and approved. And as we go through this, I'll give you a quick idea on some of these other pieces. But for now, let's just go ahead, and we'll go ahead and create a new filing. And this is where you can see initially what we'll do is offer just one type of document to be filed. And so for today, that's initiating document. And then there are subtypes for our documents. So the attorney could come through here and choose the appropriate subtype. And that, in this case, would be tax. And then if the attorney had comments for record staff, such as exhibits were to follow or something of that nature, then he could go ahead and put those in here. We'll go ahead and just leave that blank for today. I'm going to click on continue, and as you'll see, the initiating document, notice of appeal, tax followed me. The comments would follow as well. And here is where I would go ahead and upload or attach that document for the court. Go ahead and do that. The notice of appeal here. This is just looking in the My Documents on this laptop, and I'm going to go ahead and attach that. If I were in need of attaching other documents, I could go ahead and click here and continue to attach them and title them appropriately. For today, we're just going to go ahead and do the one. So I'd continue on. This screen shows us a summary, and it goes ahead and gives us the idea of the label for the type, the subtype, any comments. Shows us that there's a filing fee in this case of $212. And we have an e-filing charge here as 1 cent. This is something that we're looking into. We haven't decided for sure exactly what we're going to do for this, so it's a placeholder at this point. Total would come up to 1201 and shows the date and document name. And then right here, I can save this as a draft if I need to, or I can go ahead and submit it. I'm going to go ahead and submit it. And this comes to a shopping cart environment that if you've ever shopped online, you're probably somewhat familiar with. Gives you what you're purchasing here and shows you the charge. Then allows you to do a Visa or MasterCard as a type of payment. So today we'll choose Visa. And an expiration date. And as you can see, the information from the person's profile when they signed on came through. And what we're trying to do is allow our customers not to have to fill this out again. We get this information from the attorney's bar registration, which is part of our authentication. And if for some reason the information here is not correct in terms of billing, then they can go in here and change this information. We will not be keeping credit card information in order to be a part of Oregon's PCI or payment credit card industry compliance. We are not allowed to do that. So this information down in this part of the screen will come through. This will not. And we ask all of our attorneys and other users of this site to go ahead and read our terms and conditions and our privacy policy and agree to those. If they were to forget to do that, then we gently remind them to go back and do that. So I'm going to agree. And then right here, this is just sort of warning you. This is the last step. You will be charged at this point. So we'll go ahead and do that today. And now we're back at our e-filing application, and we have for our records a summary here. It's a confirmation screen. You also, once you submit, you will receive an email that tells you that you've submitted, and you can, of course, for here, print this for your records. Now, from here, we can go in and look on our left-hand side at our pending, and we'll see that we have an initiating document. We've got a confirmation number, which can be important if we need to track this or talk to the courts for record purposes. And then we'll go ahead from here, and I'll turn this over to my colleague, Diane, and she will show you what you will see from the internal side.
Chairman Riley and members of the committee, my name is Diane Swint, and I work for Oregon Judicial Department and have for the last 30 years, so I have a lot of experience dealing with paper. This is the first release of the case management system for the appellate courts that we installed in December of 2006, and this is the system we use to receive the documents and store them. When the clerk comes in the morning or any time during the day, she can go to her review queue to see how many documents are waiting to be filed. And when she clicks on this, it'll bring up all of those that were submitted over the last period of time that have not yet been attached to a case. In this case, we find that Aaron Brockovich and Ben Matlock have also filed things, but we're more interested in Perry Mason's tax case that he's filed. So she'll go in to view that particular document. And again, here's all the information that the e-filer saw at his end when he filed the case. In addition, we have here the transaction ID number, which is the credit card transaction, financial transaction number we need to enter into our fiscal system. So all of this information is there. The clerk then has the opportunity to look at the document and either accept it for filing or reject it. In our case, in the appellate courts, they accept 99% of the documents, but we do have to have the ability to reject in case somebody hacked in and decided to file things we didn't want in the courts. So in order to view the document, she just hits this hyperlink, and it actually brings up the document itself. And you'll notice that Perry is representing Della Street here against the Department of Revenue, and Hamilton Berger is representing the other side. So the clerk can review the document, take a look, see what's there, see if it's the correct document being filed. If she decides to reject it, she can put comments in this freeform text box, and those comments will be sent by email back to the e-filer so that the e-filer knows their document has been rejected and why. In this case, we'll accept Perry's document, and we get a confirmation that it's now been accepted. At this point in time, Perry will receive an email saying, your document's been accepted by the court. It's not yet filed, but it's been accepted for filing. The clerk then creates a case in our system, which is called, we couldn't think of a good acronym, so we call it ACMS, but it's a CTRAC-based, is the vendor, the vendor's rules engine. She fills out the information. At this point, it's not automated because they wanted to have some oversight in what's happening in this first phase. So, and then this is the confirmation that the case is created. The system automatically assigns a case number and fills some other information for the clerk. She'll then go out and grab the document, and because there may be many documents filed, she again has the ability to view it to make sure she's accepting the right one. She'll click on it, save, and this brings up our docket entry. And if you remember the screen that Bud showed you earlier that was green and black and was all codes and things, we now have a screen that's in English, which is much easier to read, contains much more information that can be extracted for our own internal performance measures or any kind of reports we want to run. It's all there. And down here is the link to the document itself. So we now are able to view the document within the system. She'll save the document. This is her confirmation that it's been saved. And she'll go back to view. This is the case register. She'll now view it. Here's the docket entry that contains the document, and over here it is again in PDF form for anyone who wants to look at it to view the document. That's the basic clerk's end of things. Very easy for the clerk to deal with. It's stored electronically. Anyone in the court system, in the appellate court system, can now view that document.
And then back on the attorney side, now that this has gone through and been given a case number, he can go back in and look on his side to the approved filing section and bring that up and see that it has been approved. There is a case number for that now. And he can actually go in at this point and see details on that and actually view the document as well. So that's sort of the complete cycle of what the document and when an attorney goes through and files, and then what it goes through our system, and then what he would see or she would see on the back end. Do we have questions?
Questions? Representative Edwards.
I'll start at the top. And you answered a lot of my questions as we went. So, the users then of all of this are primarily attorneys and court employees. It's not the general public so much.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, the initial point right now is that, however, it will evolve to everyone, the general public, being able to access that. There are a lot of pro se filers, people that want to file on their own, that would be able to. There's a lot of requests from people for copies of information from their particular case, or as just access to public records. They'd like to see information that's available, that today you walk into a courthouse, fill out a form, and pay on a per page copy that happens. So that would also be available to the general public to do it this way as well.
Okay. So, and then have you, because, I mean, I'm not an attorney and this is all new filing stuff and I mean, it's in a different language to me. So I'm wondering, did you involve involve attorneys in the development of this? I mean, I'm assuming you did, but at least like some sort of a nod that, yes, we involve people that are actually going to be using the system in the development of it.
And they're all nodding yes.
Yes, sir.
They are, which makes me feel more comfortable.
Sure, that makes me feel more comfortable.
If I might comment just real briefly on the use of other systems, when we've talked to other states and what they found, the public access views of their systems, there are these other side tangible benefits. What we have seen is that moms have been looking up to see who their daughters were dating and what type of driving records they had. And they've also looked at when they were looking for new babysitters to see if they had other records. So there are other things like that that we've seen as a tangible benefit that people are using the information more than just for attorneys to file.
Mm-hmm. Another question? So what's the education process been like will the education be like to make sure that frequent users would know? I mean, my experience with going electronic on some of these things has been what we have to do as elected officials and candidates with our filing of our, like, our campaign finance records and whatnot. And you know, I know how to use that system now, but there was a learning curve, and there was somebody that I could call, and there still is somebody that I can call in the Secretary of State's office if I'm having a problem with the filing and whatnot. What type of support and training are you offering to likely users?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, excellent question. We are adopting a model that has already been used with the federal courts and the same process they went to educate people, because they're have gone through this process and are now mandating it to be that way. It does include classroom based training where they will have to go through in order to be able to use the system. We're also focusing heavily on our support structure, both phone and online help desk that will be available for this. Because of that, business transformation is really the focus of what's going on. The, you know, the filing technology is something that's been there. A significant part of what we're doing is dedicated to make sure that the training and then the follow-up training and the support structure is in place, and that is key to this being successful.
Any questions?
So with the training, is there'll be a cost involved? Is that a part of the funding for this project, or will users that want to be trained be asked to pay a fee for the training, or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edwards, the a significant amount of the training costs are already built into this structure. One of the nice things that we have and have worked with the Bar Association, in particular based on the federal model, again, is that the training does include CLE credit for them. So they're it offers a benefit that way, and then they're actually using their resources to augment the training to make sure everyone gets trained. They're also offering facilities and their different venues, everything from formal to brown bag lunch and learns and such that go on throughout the state. So we are tapping into existing things that are already there and then augmenting that with additional programs.
I do have just a couple more. Okay.
Please, go ahead.
The moving forward, you spoke of an e-filing charge. Will that be something that you'll be coming in front of the legislature to establish in 2009? What that is, or do you have authority to establish what that fee is?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Evans, I don't have the exact answer if we have the authority or not. One of the things we're working on right now is we wanted to have the ability to do that if we had the authority to do that. So right now it is a placeholder within the system, and one of the things is we have we want to put a work group together to talk about if that one is doable. What are the steps to do that if we want to move forward with that?
And part of that might be a recovery fee for credit card charges.
Yes, sir, that's possible.
And I think I had one. I think I'm down to one additional question.
Okay, we'll give you one more.
You spoke a little bit about, I'm not sure that I understood what you were explaining about the single case management system, and we're on a single case management system now, and this would allow you to move to a different type of a system, or this is the implementation of an electronically based single case management.
Instead of answering that question,
yeah.
I'm going to pursue a little bit of that line of questioning after,
okay,
and in a little more detail. So if you
okay
can hold
no,
that one.
Yeah, that's fine.
Representative Wire.
Is there a filing fee now on just the paper process?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beyer, there is a filing fee that exists today, and there's different fees depending on what documents you're filing. What we have the flexibility in the system to do is to have for lack of a better term, a convenience fee. And that would allow for a cost, whether it's to recuperate credit card charges or to offset costs that people pay today for that process. If you think about the process of what happens today, someone has to prepare all the documents and paper, then they have a courier take it to the courthouse, and then all that time and cost are passed on to whoever the attorney's represented. So two steps. One, it would eliminate that cost being passed on, and since they're already paying to have all of these services done, it's an opportunity to potentially recoup some of those costs for us.
One more.
Go ahead.
And I know we're not in Ways and Means, and I know that we have someone in the back listening, but can you remind me where we ended at the end of last session on the funding of this? I see, you know, the certificates of participation and stuff, but...
I knew we'd get you up here.
I know. Couldn't resist. For the record, I'm Sarah Gates, Deputy State Court Administrator, and you start talking budget, and I just can't resist. I thought I'd better come up here. I'd like to, if I may, Chair Riley, address Representative Byer's question. We were given $2 million at the end of last session to continue our planning process, and that was in our current biennial budget. We are back before Ways and Means this session asking for certificates of participation to move forward with the first two stages of this project.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Thacker.
Thank you, Chair Riley. And while we're talking about budget, the screen wasn't up there very long, but there was a chart showing the different phases and how much it might cost. And I imagine that's in today's dollars. And correct me if I'm wrong, was it around $1 billion total? And it's probably in today's dollars, right?
Chair Riley, Representative Thacker, those costs are in today's dollars. That is correct. We are anticipating the total cost of the system to be $118 million over about 5 to 7 years, depending how fast the rollout is. The important thing to note about those cost estimates is we have not done a single procurement yet. Those are estimates. And over 35% of those costs are related to contingency and the implementation, the business transformation, the change management, the training. It's not all hardware and software that we're looking at.
100 million is a lot better than
yes, because I didn't know if those figures were thousands or millions. I was like glancing at them. But follow up. I'm wondering, thank you for clarifying. It makes
my pleasure.
Were you anticipating offsetting any of those costs through convenience fees? Because you're just highlighting how it sounds like it actually is a benefit to the state as well as to the people who use the system. And I'm wondering if there's going to be like a, I don't know.
Chair Riley, Representative Thacker, there's several models out there that we are exploring. One is in the federal system today, there is a per fee charge to view documents. That is, we're looking at the content management, the repository for all of that pieces of paper and images as a source of potential revenue. Right now, we charge 25 cents a page for paper copies. In the federal system, they have a lower price per page, and it's much more convenient. And so we're looking at that as an opportunity to fund future improvements and potentially pay off debt service. The other is the opportunity to look at something like an e-filing convenience fee. We have not set anything up yet, but we've put a placeholder in the system so we can have that discussion with our stakeholders. But absolutely, we're looking at those options.
Okay. That's all.
Thank you. As I indicated, I have a few questions. Some of the questions were already asked, thank goodness, but because I want to get out of here in about 15 minutes. But as some of you know, I have a little experience with case-following systems. I designed a case-following system, and the green screen looks very much like the one I designed back in 1972. You've come a long way. But in listening to, and I was at the Ways and Means hearing yesterday, and listening to the judge who presented a piece of that, he talked about the replacement of the case-following system, which we have not looked at today. What we looked at today is a filing system, mm-hmm. Which would probably front-end a case-following system to some degree. What I heard him say was that now, with this new system, they'll be able to have a much easier job in determining what should be done with the defendant in front of him, because he would be able to see more than the current case. And in the system I designed, that was all you could see because that's all there was. And that's been around, yours has been around almost as long as that. Can you tell me, and one of the things he mentioned was, today, if someone comes in and uses a false ID, spells his name differently, has a different address, et cetera, et cetera, there's no way to connect those. How are you going to do that with the new system? And if you'd talk just a little bit about what the judge sees and at the end of all this process.
Chair Riley, members of the committee, one point of clarification. The system that we're showing right now is the appellate or Court of Appeals front-end piece, and then the case processing behind that. Judge Marcus, who talked yesterday at Ways and Means, is talking about our current system, which does look like the green screen that we showed earlier. Again, a case-based system, so you can only see the information within that one case. The transformation that we're talking about making is to a person-based system. Most of the court vendors have evolved into that model where it's not a single case. It is the ability to tie all those cases by person or by family, so you can see that holistic view. So, for example, if Judge Marcus wanted to see a family case because it's a judgment on guardianship for a child, for example, today they would not be able to see if one or if the parent had other charges or other outstanding warrants. The holistic view is that he would be able to see all the information for all the members of that family. So it could be custody, it could be traffic, it could be drugs and such. All the information you wouldn't have that you'd be able to aggregate together based on that whole family or based on a person. And that's that type of paradigm shift from a case model to a person model is really the transformation that the systems have been evolving to.
And is that based on some sort of percentage matching? I mean, in the old days, we had to have the ID look exactly alike. And now you can use more percentage matching. How closely does this person match to the one in front of me? Is that what's going on?
Yes, sir, that's exactly what's going on. It's having the system also to look at the percentage of if the name, the birth date, if we have driver's license, if we have social security number, what percentage of the number of characteristics match to say that these are probably the same person, and the then ability to at least know there might be potential out there that allow you to look deeper into that. A lot of times we've seen birth dates where you just transform two of the digits in the month, for example, but the day and the year are exactly the same and the name's exactly the same. But because there was just a data entry error, today those two records would not be associated. Or if we used a middle initial or spelled out the whole middle name, those two would not be associated, but it would be able to say Christopher J. and Christopher John, and birth date and address are exactly the same. It would show those to say high probability that these are the same, this is the same person, where today they would not be correlated together.
Okay, and I'll get back to other members in a minute. When this process that we're looking at is finished, that isn't what we're talking about now. Is that correct? These are two separate, completely separate systems. He's nodding and you're looking questioning.
when everything's all done, all of these systems will be interlinked. The data integration piece, the backbone that ties everything together, ties it all. They're modular components, so today we have one giant integrated system, the financials, the case, and everything. You want to change one piece, you actually have this huge ripple effect
that you could break something else. What we're talking about with using some of the web-based technologies is each piece is a standalone component. So if you want to be able to upgrade one piece or change one particular piece, it does not impact the other pieces. So the e-filing piece is one component of it. The appellate case management system is, again, one component. And the trial court case management will be a different component, but the information has to feed into the appellate case management system.
Right. And what I'm getting at is the numbers that we talked about, the 100 million, is what I'm asking you about, is that included in that budget or is that a different budget?
Chair Riley, that's included in the $100 million. Right. This person-based, statewide case management, financial management, right. document management system, is that's the entire, the whole thing.
Okay, that's where I wanted to get at. And I don't imagine that I think you're quite right when you say that when one section of this is changed, it won't affect the other sections. I don't believe that for a second. But any other questions?
I have one additional question.
All right, you can have one more because we've got 5 minutes.
As you spoke about the moving from case-based to person-based, which I think, I mean, makes a ton of sense. This whole project just makes a ton of sense to me. In the back of my mind, though, there was a little piece of me thinking, okay, who are the stakeholders that are involved in this and looking at it? Because I'm thinking attorneys, I'm thinking law enforcement, I'm thinking civil liberties advocates, I'm thinking privacy advocates. I mean, are all those people at the table?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edwards, they are at the table. We have been meeting with all of those agencies and organizations and groups talking about what we're doing and making sure there's an understanding of what eCourt will do. We're not just talking with public safety agencies. We're reaching out to all people that have to interact with the courts from all levels, whether that's the sheriff's department to local health and human services agencies that have an impact here, different advocacy groups that are there through all formal committees and channels. We've been making sure we're trying to reach out to everyone as much as possible to make sure we're getting the word out. Here's what we're doing. We want to make sure that your input is there and is included in what we're doing. And that's part of what we've been doing as the planning stage, is making sure we're getting that message out and getting the feedback from everyone to say, make sure you include this, make sure you understand how this impacts us.
Further questions?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I just wondered if it also included the courier union, because it sounds like we might. No, I'm sorry.
You're joking. Okay, that's good. Do you have any further, closing comments before we wrap this up? No? All right. Thank you very much for coming. It's been very informative, and I appreciate you being here. And with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing.